5 years ago, the world was waking up to the dangers of a tricky little airborne microorganism that attacks the upper respiratory tract, sets the systems of the human body on fire. The coronavirus pandemic claimed millions of lives and resulted in millions more chronic illnesses and disabilities. It brought the global economy to its knees. Illness in general, and pandemics in particular, can be seen as universal human tragedies, but like so many so-called great equalizers, it revealed just how deep the inequalities go. The path the virus tore through our societies revealed vast social divides, historic injustices, and governmental failures as many people across the world were effectively abandoned to the disease with very little protections. And prisoners were some of the most exposed populations, with infection rates sky high in cramped conditions. It was not the first or the last time where containment and contagion went hand in hand, or when a pandemic had an outsized role in deepening inequality. In a new book, A History of the World in Six Plagues, Edna Bonham explores the interconnected histories of two inescapable facts of modernity: mass confinement and mass infection. The political history of epidemics can tell us a lot about how the world we know was made, from their spread to their research, their treatment, their policing, the conspiracy theories and rumours that spring up in their wake. Edna Bonham is a historian of science, a culture writer and a journalist. She's a contributing writer for Freeze magazine and the co-editor of After Sex, an anthology about reproductive justice. Her writing has appeared widely in outlets including The Atlantic, The Baffler, The Guardian, London Review of Books, The Nation, and The Washington Post. We talked about cholera, Ebola, sleeping sickness, and COVID-19, about plantation medicine, prison organizing, fascism, and the evolution of race science. Edna, hello, welcome onto the show.
Hi, Eleanor. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to speak with you.
Oh, I'm so excited too. So tell us how you began to think about the connections between forms of containment and forms of contagion. I guess, how did this project emerge out of your other work and research?
One of the things that I do in the book is actually I start with my childhood and a very early experience of having had a specific illness and the ways in which I felt confined. And part of the reason I started with the self, not to get too psychoanalytic, is to really try to engage with the idea or fact that so often how we respond to everyday events as adults very much emerge and begin with how we experience the world in our early state. So the book is six different case studies that might on the surface seem quite different, but actually the thing that keeps them and binds them together is some form of forced confinement and or self-confinement and self-exile to people trying to, in their best way, think about how they can be resilient. So I start with the plantation and thinking actively about what the plantation might do to an enslaved person and an enslaved body, especially with respect to brewing pandemics and brewing epidemics with respect to cholera. But then I move in time to looking at medical concentration camps in East Africa during European colonialism and what is now Tanzania, to thinking about what HIV/AIDS looked like at a women's prison and how people understood what care and what we would consider to be mutual aid could look like, even in one of the most horrific forms of confinement that people are subjected to.
Let's start with your first case study, the plantation. Tell me more about how in your study, the movement of cholera, the kind of nature of the spread of the disease gives us a lens through which to view the nature of domination and degradation central to chattel slavery. It's kind of revelatory of the dynamics of property ownership and violence that subtend this economic and social setup.
Yeah, so I guess I want to take a step back because I realized I hadn't defined like what is an epidemic and like how that in some sense also influences and impacts how we could think about chattel slavery. And one thing I would say is that in thinking about the book, and not just as a kind of historical text, but also one that's both critical and philosophical, I want to play with what an epidemic can mean and also distinguishing between disease and illness. Disease, that is, if one could have an exposure to a contagion such as tuberculosis, but how our body responds to it impacts, determines whether or not how ill we can get. And in thinking about an epidemic at the level of society, there was a period in a pre-modern era where whether something was endemic and epidemic kind of felt the same because we didn't understand how contagions operated. People were sick all the time, and obviously life expectancy were far lower than they are today. And there's a turning point in the 19th century, which is where I begin, and that epidemics, as we understand it, is something that shows that there's an exception to how illness, and more specifically, how illnesses can create mass death. Obviously, there's the Black Plague and Black Death of the 14th century, which also had a mark and was seen as an exception. But the modern context and how people respond, I think, also dovetails with the rise of industrialization and how diseases spread within urban centers, the ways in which medicine starts to become more refined, how the clinic, as Michel Foucault has written about in The Birth of the Clinic, also speaks to a specific historical turning point in medicine. It becomes something that is institutionalized and is also state-driven through the government, is one of the things that is at the backdrop of what I'm looking at. And so when we think about, or when one thinks about plantation and what does that mean and what does that look like in the context of not just my book, but the scholarship of other people, such as Deidre Cooper-Owens, who's looked at medicine on the plantation and under slavery in her book, Medical Bondage, it is something that then we have to ask ourselves, okay, there's on the one hand, this sense of progress that is happening in society with the institutionalization of things like education, medicine, the natural sciences as we understand it. But at the same time, we also have some of the most brutal forms of social confinement. And we see that on the plantation, we see that through colonialism, we see that elsewhere. And part of what I was trying to look at in this particular chapter of contagion on the plantation is to understand how those brutal forms of social organization could operate. And so I start off with a very ideological example. Samuel Cartwright, who is a white Southerner who was also a scientist in what is now Louisiana, and who gives a lecture to a room of men proclaiming the inferiority of Black people. And part of the reason I wanted to start with that is just to show how science at that time was often using, or the people who were practicing science at that time, many of them were often using the discipline to justify slavery. And with that, then to determine whether or not people were worthy of care and so forth. And this is important to highlight insofar that it also determined in some cases what a healthy body looked like, what reproduction looked like, what birthing practices would look like, and also the rise of gynecology and the extent to which enslaved people were often used as a subject for understanding and for experimenting. And so this is the backdrop and of that chapter. But what I very much wanted to be the foreground of it is thinking about an individual person who autobiography I read, Harriet Jacobs, and she had been an enslaved person who, in reading her memoir about motherhood, about her own confinement on a plantation in North Carolina, I wanted to get a sense of what was everyday life like. And what I started to see is just the, you know, illness and the kind of perpetual illness emerge within the text. But beyond that, she wasn't the only formerly enslaved person who wrote about her encounter in the United States of and how medicine and contagion operated. So I looked at the life of Frederick Douglass, who also spoke about this, and some others. But the thing that was the most surprising and perhaps I didn't expect to find as I was looking at archival material was that in addition to the establishment of what is scientific racism, there was also the kind of forceful intervention of some of these, what I would say to be physicians of the time, to have this plantation medicine or so-called plantation medicine, to then use the various homeopathic methods to treat enslaved subjects who were on the plantation. On the one hand, there was a kind of thriving pseudoscientific practice that said that these people, Black folk, were unworthy of care. But then there was also, at the same time, pseudoscientific ideas or principles around how to heal those very people in the places that made them sick. And working through the archival materials by enslaved subjects like Harriet Jacobs and Frederick Douglass and others, alongside the antiquated and racist scientific, quote-unquote scientific text of people like Samuel Cartwright in the plantation manuals, was part of also getting the picture of what, how we can frame this rubric of disease flourishing on what I consider to be a torture camp, that is the plantation.
You say quote-unquote scientific, which is a really interesting way of framing the dilemma of, is it a no true Scotsman kind of thing of say that here is real science over here that we can agree with, sign off on as a robust independent practice, and over here is the kind of like horrors of plantation medicine as you were outlining. I'm wondering in your work how you go about navigating the entanglement of those two categories, like, you know, how does it trouble our ability to think about medicine and think about the history of medicine?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question insofar that science and how we define it has been evolving and contested as well for centuries and centuries. And I think that one of the things that was so significant for me as someone who studied microbiology and did a thesis in it, is that it gave me some insight into the rigor that's required to carry out an experiment, and to also know that there is sometimes errors that can arise within the context of a laboratory. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I also explore in my chapter on Robert Koch, who was a German scientist who won the Nobel Prize in the early 20th century. The sense of what does it mean to practice, to in some cases spend decades working on one specific issue, whether it's muscular dystrophy or the figuring out the genetic configuration of human life. All of this takes extensive amount of time, and in some cases when we find out more information, then it gives us the opportunity to adjust accordingly. Nevertheless, when it comes down to questions around infectious diseases, which is ultimately what this book is looking at, I also come to think about, and people have written about it, how for a while during the 20th century, infectious diseases were declining, a lot of which had to do with massive vaccination campaigns in what are developed, quote unquote, developed countries, such as North America, Western Europe, and so forth, and the eradication of smallpox being quite significant in helping to reduce the spread of infectious diseases. But then there was also another important element, which is that in addition to these vaccination campaigns helping with the decline, the robust kind of funding of public health departments was absolutely important and pivotal to ensuring that people could survive and live longer. And this is important to know when we think about how diseases travel, the things that might fuel it outside of the biological microorganisms moving back and forth, but also just how public health, which is related to officials and those trained in science, interpret science as a practice. And so in thinking about this very sensitive kind of relationship between what we now consider to be peer-reviewed scientific material and research and how we interpret it, I think the past 5 years since 2020 has shown that there are people who look at that with good faith in the sense that there are some things that are still being contested. And there are those who have another agenda that isn't just about working with as evidence-based approaches, but rather with politics. And I think a glaring example of that in the present day, if I think about specifically the vaccination question, is someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who I doubt is looking at peer-reviewed, evidence-based, scientific material, primary literature, but very much has a political agenda against vaccination without considering the kind of long durée of what vaccines have done to save lives, rather focusing on what I would consider to be a limited and myopic perspective on disease transmission and infectious diseases.
Absolutely. I'd like to return to the question of the plantation for a moment to hear more about what plantation medicine looked like and its relationship to race making, race science. Something that kept striking me as I read the book was the importance of the legibility or non-legibility, obviously, of pain and how central that seems to be to a lot of the political questions that crop up in your work.
Yeah, so one thing I would say is that I owe a lot to the research that has been done previously by historians of medicine or historians generally who've looked at this very question. So Dorothy Roberts, whose book Healing the Black Body has been pivotal to this research, as well as the works of Harriet Washington. Her book Medical Apartheid also is quite significant. But beyond that, and this is where literary criticism and literary scholars have also been important. And I think of Sadia Hartman's work, Scenes of Subjection, where she is quite informative in thinking about what does the diffusion of terror under the plantation look like, and how did 19th century ideas about paternalism create a specific condition in which a enslaved person's humanity was taken away. And all this foundation, I think, was pivotal for me asking a certain set of questions and thinking about what the plantation looked like so that I can then also try to understand what plantation medicine may, whatever that might be called, and or however that might be interpreted. One must also consider the everyday life and the rigorous kind of research that was done previously. And for me, part of, I guess, what I wanted to explore was how the plantation and gave birth in many cases to people who were then considered to be subjected to property, but that beyond that, what role did enslaved women have who, in some cases, being the primary carers and givers and also midwives to ensure the regeneration of the next generation of enslaved people, not because they wanted that, but because they were forming communities that was important. And so in thinking about what that constituted in this environment, I then thought, okay, well, it isn't the case that people were just mostly just working on the plantation on the field, but that there are people working in different capacities. What did the knowledge practice of some of the enslaved people look like? And Frederick Douglass in particular mentioned that a little bit, and specifically in a person that was referred to as uncle, and how an enslaved person and how he was considered a doctor amongst the community that was there. Or in the case of Harriet Jacobs, quite something, an opposite experience where one of the people who terrorized her and like quite directly and to the point of physical assault was a white doctor who was overseeing enslaved people. And so seeing this contradiction between those who might not have been seen as healers by virtue of them being enslaved and Black in the South in the United States during the 19th century, alongside white and plantation owners or people who were on the periphery of being associated with plantation owners causing great harm, is something that I wanted to look at as I was working through this text. But, and this is one thing that didn't necessarily enter fully deeply into the material, but I reference within that chapter, is also, well, would it it mean for then people who had been enslaved, once they were emancipated, what were the possibilities for them to improve their health? And within that chapter, I briefly talk about that period of Reconstruction where the Freedmen Bureau, which was a body of people who had been freed, wanted to provide free education and did provide free education as well as free healthcare to formerly enslaved people. And it was also during this period, during Reconstruction, that there was a resurgence of Black medical schools that were being established, some of which trained a huge generation of physicians, Black physicians who provided care to their community. And outside of the kind of very bellicose situation that was produced in the plantation, I wanted to also consider what was the possibility that of actually healing and allowing oneself to create another vision and sense of self that wasn't just about the plantation. And that period of Reconstruction, which Robin D.G. Kelly writes extensively about, a historian, is so pivotal to thinking about what could have been. And we know what has been with respect to public education in the U.S. insofar that the model that was set by formerly enslaved people to say we want universal education still exists with us today in the context of the U.S. It is because of the Reconstruction that free and public education was made available quite sooner than it would have been if not. and I would argue that if Reconstruction had gone on longer, that could have also been applied to ensuring that there could have been free and universal healthcare quite like in the U.S., which is still not a given, but that could have been possible if Reconstruction and true equality and true reparations was made to the people who had been dispossessed in that country.
Mm. It brings us on to your writing about health activism, health organizing in the context of prisons. There's a really fascinating example of AIDS activism that takes place within prisons. Can you tell us a bit about that and what that tells us about the possibilities of working class organization when it focuses on the kinds of groups and categorizations of people who are reliably exposed both to incarceration and to infection?
When I studied public health at Columbia, one of the things that we looked at extensively was the rise of HIV, how various countries responded to it, and the communities that were often considered vulnerable. And so often the ways in which it was spoken about in public health language is that X group was a vector of disease. And I often felt uncomfortable with that language. Some of those groups being things like demographics, such as people who engage in sex work, people who are intravenous drug users, and sometimes even racializing that the groups of people who may disproportionately have HIV. And again, that made me uncomfortable. And during that period of time and looking at the data and the research, I wanted to go deeper, and I also wanted to understand not just the disease as people who may or may not be susceptible, but also what did life look like for those who weren't just infected, but also might be part of a community and might have an identity that exists well beyond their status. And so, as most people might know, millions of people since the 80s have been affected with it. And since then, there have been life-saving antiretroviral medication, and we owe a lot to the scientists who've been able to develop that treatment. But one population that did come up quite often in the literature that I looked at was prison populations and how HIV/AIDS was common. And so in thinking about that, I wanted to consider, okay, what is a prison and what is actually happening in that space of confinement? And here, Foucault also ignited my imagination insofar that I wanted to consider how in Discipline and Punishment, he makes a case for how prison isn't just about the confinement. It's about also inflicting pain and suffering. And it is a special case in which the punished are derived so much of life, movement, even their time.
And so in looking through archival materials and looking through newspaper clippings and so forth, I kind of fell onto the case of Bedford Hills, which is a women's prison in New York State, not too far from New York City, where actually in the late 80s, there were people in that prison, women who had HIV. And part of what was interesting about this place as a case study is that the women in that community, as much as it was difficult to live and be denied the ability to be free, created what is considered to be a mutual aid program. They provided each other with emotional support. They were able to provide care. They were able to provide psychological support, healing circles, and so forth. And they did it not because the warden of the prison indicated that, but rather it was self-initiated, and it was done through love and care for each other. And that program became a model for other types of prison programs in which people provided mutual aid and support with each other. And in addition to that, and this is the part that was so fascinating to me, some of them wrote articles, scientific public health articles, as well as a book on this very, on the very program that they created. But beyond that, what was exciting to me about this program, and more specifically the women at Bedford Hills, is that it looked very familiar to me to what people who were part of ACT UP did in the 80s and 90s in New York City around AIDS advocacy and social justice. And no, they couldn't protest on the street at Bedford Hills for obvious reasons, but they could use the space and operate with as much agency as they could in that context to show what is possible to challenge the very brutal and prohibitive parameters that are often put into the prison. And so this is actually, I thought it was a somewhat hopeful environment. And even though it's like, one can make the case, well, reform isn't enough, like I'm for prison abolition and I wouldn't want them to be incarcerated. Or I didn't want, as I was reading through this material, I didn't want them, any of these people, to be incarcerated. And I wouldn't advocate for a softer prison approach. But nevertheless, I think in looking at these case studies or a case study like this, one can see how humans and how people actually are far more caring to each other, even in conditions that are horrific, than they are, yeah, brutal or acrimonious to one another.
Often in pandemics, the public space and also a shared domestic settings become figures of paranoia and surveillance in parallel and entangled ways. Can you tell us about how that came through in your studies, and I guess what that tells us about how governments have surveilled and policed pandemics?
It's really in the mid-19th century that when what we consider to be public health starts to emerge through this International Sanitary Commissions. Mm. In 1851, various representatives from various countries met to discuss what does it mean to control and particularly have similar types of rules around how people treat disease. And this mattered because this was specifically thinking about ports and the ways in which diseases were often thought to travel between different port cities. So one of the last plagues that had happened in Europe was in Marseille in 1721. And 100 years later, people were like, okay, cholera is also an issue. And that coordination amongst countries in the 1840s and 50s was an attempt to at least monitor trade, which is something I actually did look at my dissertation. And fast forward to the 20th century, that is something that was still prevalent as a subject to consider. So in thinking about the League of Nations and after World War I, and the idea that the flu and being able to control for infectious outbreaks, not just during periods of peace, but also during periods of war, was also quite significant. So this then becomes, I would say, part of the initial stage of thinking about, through this international collaboration, whether it was the International Sanitary Commission, the League of Nations having a health department, and eventually with the World Health Organization, the idea that there should be some type of record keeping around diseases, there should be regulation or at least suggestions around what one could do, and then coordination more specifically with how governments may respond. So say all of that because it's important to think about how, at least on a global level, various countries have been trying to think actively about disease and contagion. And that in some cases, some of it was well-meaning, and having international approaches actually does make sense to an extent. But what does that look like when we consider who's involved or not involved? What does that look like if countries that may not have an equal say about other forms of health equities, particularly in thinking about the differences between countries that may have universal health programs and those that do not? What does it mean for formerly colonized peoples and subjects to get their due with respect to health equity, as opposed to just being the subjects of medical experimentation? All of this is important for thinking then about, in the modern context, the question around surveillance and health is quite significant and complicates perhaps what could be a well-meaning way of thinking about monitoring health and being mindful of the threat of infectious disease, as well as endemic diseases. So the surge in cancer rates in the global south. Alongside that, if we think about the HIV/AIDS case, how the pharmaceutical companies were undercutting free and universal distribution of life-saving drugs during the late 90s, early 2000s, and what it would have meant if those drugs, antiretroviral drugs and medication, was made available for free in places in the global south. Surveillance and what it means cannot be taken away from these broader issues around power, around colonial decisions around health, but also just like the historical and very real issues concerning medical experimentations amongst or towards people in the global south, towards people of color in the global north. How we manage that in a way that's equitable is still an ongoing question. And yet, I would say that some of the most exciting research on this right now, in terms of people who are asking great questions on this, is Lyell Liverpool, who wrote this book, Systemic, which highlights this on a global scale, and Uschi Blackstock, who also wrote extensively about this in her book, Legacy. And they're thinking actively about what is this relationship between trying to solve real problems of people getting sick and also racialized people, but then how do we do so without causing further damage and hierarchies of, and also pushing the ethical health of society as well.
I think something that's a really revealing example that you've mentioned already, and I'd like to go into more detail about it, is the case of Dr. Robert Koch and his experiments, his studies of sleeping sickness, where we can see the technologies of kind of colonial population control, like punitive technologies that then evolve into basically the Holocaust, and evolving alongside the truly useful studies in science.
I first learned about Robert Koch when I was in high school, mm-hmm. and mostly because we had to learn some of his postulates around biology, mm-hmm. and learning it within that context in a very sterile environment in which rote memorization was very much part of my educational experience and memory. Nevertheless, his legacy and who he represented, as I got to learn more about this person, being a physician, a microbiologist, German, and him establishing a name for himself as well in later life for being a kind of microbe hunter against epidemics. And at the time that I wrote the chapter, I was also, or I am, living in Berlin, where the very institute that's informing Germans, residents in Germany, about outbreaks or the various public health indicators, that institute is called the Robert Koch Institute. And his memory is strong felt, particularly because of his contribution to the natural sciences, which I do recognize and it's quite significant. But at the same time, he, like some of his colleagues, were also agents of colonialism, and thinking at least they were able to, because of their positions as being part of and members of a colonial empire, then able to travel quite freely and openly and so forth. And part of what I wanted to explore, especially being here in Berlin, is looking at his statue, which is in the one of his statues, which is in the center of Berlin, where his lab was, and cycling around the city and trying to find the physical landscape that he was working in 100 years later. But then beyond that, his archival materials. And so looking at his journals and letters at the Staatsbibliothek here in Berlin, the National Library, and seeing in the flesh how he came to study, do research, but then his brief time in East Africa. And considering that, I saw him and seeing his work not just as a kind of anomaly of him being in East Africa and thinking about trying to solve the sleeping sickness epidemic, which was prominent in the late 19th, early 20th century, but to also consider it alongside the fact that Berlin was also the site in which the African continent was, without the consultation of Africans, divided and given to various European provenance and so forth, but also considering how medicine was deeply entangled into these political reconfigurations and how scientists were also involved without considering the, in some cases, the true humanity of Africans and subjects. And at the time, there are people who have looked at this period and also considered how this then applied to German colonialism in Southwest Africa, what is now present-day Namibia, and how the genocidal practices by Germans towards Herero and Nama people became a kind of dress rehearsal or blueprint for genocidal practices during the Holocaust. And Zoe Sabuzzi has written excellent work on this. I would also elaborate that with my particular kind of intervention and in thinking about East Africa, sleeping sickness became a way in which the colonial practices of medical experimentation was also put forth. And so some of the scientists were there in East Africa and in Namibia. So Eugene Fischer being one example, were also part of the machinery of creating, quote unquote, creating and participating in Nazi science. And this, that chapter is also really thinking deeply about how various forms of colonialism, which, you know, Hannah Arendt spoke about in The Origins of Totalitarianism, helped to fuel the fascism that came to bear. And years ago, when I was thinking about Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, Ami Cézé's work also played a role in having me think about this. Like, you cannot, like, fascism is not just a European kind of foundation. It is very much deeply connected to the colonial projects on the African continent. And Ami Cézé and Hannah Arendt both were able to theorize around this, around the time that the Holocaust was occurring. And reading those texts alongside each other helped to deepen my, at least theoretical and philosophical, way of approaching this complicated history.
That dynamic whereby claims about health, paranoia about health that flourishes in the context of mass death, seems very relevant to our current moment, where I think it's fair to say we can see a lot of people experiencing the pinch point of, on the one hand, degrading social conditions, a very recent pandemic, and on the other hand, rising fascism, by doubling down on health fixations and health paranoia. There does seem to be a kind of political primacy invested in having a coherent, whole, perfect, uninfected body. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that in the context of your writing about COVID-19, of course, our most recent pandemic at time of recording.
Yeah, so I think that's an excellent question, and it's like a delicate one, in that what does it mean to work through
living in this world and living in this world in such a fashion that we feel good about our bodies, we feel healthy, we feel as if we can live and function in a way that we can love and think and grow without pain. The reason I'm turning to such a general way of thinking about this is that in working through not just this book and through COVID as a historian of science, I was very much inspired by, for example, Susan Sontag's work, Illness as Metaphor, where she goes and weaves through this very philosophical way of thinking about how diseases are not just an ailment, but there's a way in which our socially constructed ideas about who gets to be human, who gets to be whole, impacts how we then understand who is sick and who isn't perennially and so forth. And it goes back to maybe my slight discomfort around who can be considered a vector of disease, because certain bodies can often be seen as such, not for any biological fact, but just by virtue of how the hierarchies that are constructed through society. And so in some cases, that can be anything from Sabrina String's work, for example, Fearing the Black Body, thinks about like how fat phobia and the body is rooted in anti-blackness and anti-black racism. And it's an excellent study that goes into the sociology of that. But then beyond that, there's also just the kind of ways in which people who are living with chronic and endemic diseases are also trying to work through on a personal level what that means. And I'm thinking of Ann Boyer's work, The Undying, and it's a cancer memoir in which it's a beautiful text that really goes into detail about her own everyday experience of having to deal with breast cancer and chemotherapy and so forth. And these texts are significant in so far that they operate as a framework for us to move beyond the body and to also to consider what baggage we all hold about others when we think about who can be healthy or sick and so forth. Now, in the context of COVID-19, so much was put forth with respect to in the beginning, and this is something that I recalled writing about, how in the US, African Americans, Black Americans were considered to be a vector of disease, insofar that they were seen as more susceptible to getting COVID than any other group, I think with the exception of Native Americans, and also seen as having like more likely to die if infected. And if taken on a kind of face value, that this seems a bit off. And what people who did the work, like the analysis, like Evelyn Hammes, a professor at Harvard, is to look at, well, okay, what types of jobs do people have? And how does the labor that one has impact exposure, potential exposure to the disease? And then and beyond that, like, what is the healthcare system like in the US and who has access to care? And so with the first one, it was like disproportionately, like African Americans, Black Americans were disproportionately essential workers in some cases in some cities, and in some cases also disproportionately incarcerated, which also impacted transmission rates. And so one had to look beyond the data to see what is the social organization of America and how does that fuel the disease. That was absolutely pivotal and important. But beyond that, it's okay, how do you address once people get sick, who gets better? And in a country that still has about 30 million people without health insurance, it is absolutely insidious to blame the people who got sick and not the system that doesn't even provide the care to begin with. And so this is also a dynamic where for me, in trying to really push against basic and reductionist narratives around health, it means looking beyond the data and to actually understand what's happening. And with COVID, what could have helped when people were clapping for healthcare workers and so forth is actually paying nurses and doctors and janitors in hospitals and clinics a better wage. What could have helped was actually increasing public health funding mechanisms,
or providing, and this is something that did happen in Germany, providing people with full like compensation if they stayed home. And some artists and writers were provided that here in Germany initially when the lockdown happened. And I say this because the question around public health, the question around how to ensure that people feel well, isn't just about mandates and lockdowns. It's also having in place a robust health system that isn't going through the type of austerity that has wrecked a lot of nations globally, like in North America, but also with the NHS and the rampant austerity that has been impacting it over the past 30 years. One of the things that I think is also important if we think about right now the defunding of the USAID is that while there's an extent to which US foreign aid can be effective, it also harbors a kind of a neoliberal situation in which the US becomes a war donor to nation states that should be able to have primary care and public health systems within those nation states as opposed to relying on charity. And so this is also another element of how do we think about public health, not just in terms of aid that is being provided to from the West and so forth, but as actual deep and meaningful reparations that allows people and countries to survive and thrive and be active agents of their own health systems so that communicable diseases or non-communicable diseases are not flourishing in the ways that they have been.
So you quote Ibrahim Abdullah and Ismail Rashid saying Ebola was not simply a deadly viral disease, it was the manifestation of neoliberalism as an affliction which wreaks havoc in the world's most vulnerable societies. Now, we've been talking a lot, your book is very engaged in the relationship between the biological and the social, how the one is revelatory of the other. I'm curious about why infectious diseases specifically, rather than other conditions, which a lot of people think are kind of more typical of what we might very loosely be able to call modernity, right? Like heart disease, right? Inflammatory conditions, this kind of thing.
Yeah, so one thing I would say is that there should be no reason that infectious diseases are flourishing in the way that they are in the world. And that has a lot to do with the divestment of health in a true equitable sense globally. And I say this mostly because of how not just vaccination or pharmaceutical drugs are distributed, but also that when the Ebola virus had its impacted West Africa, what could have helped is the kind of increase, which should have happened well beforehand, of hospitals, clinics, physicians, and facilities to provide care for people. And part of the reason that a lot of that didn't exist, and I talk about that in the Ebola chapter, is the history and legacy of colonialism. And Liberia was an interesting case because of its relationship to the United States and its relative independence. But nevertheless, the partitioning of the continent in the way that it was, the extraction and dispossession, which Walter Rodney talks about, of how Europe underdeveloped Africa, and how that then creates a social dynamic of abject lowering of quality of life for so many people, it then means that if there is any kind of outbreak, it can run like wildfire and it can keep growing and so forth. And so by the time that there's a malaria outbreak or even yellow fever and so forth, it can flourish in ways in some of these post-colonial contexts that it doesn't in, or at least not yet, in North America, but who knows what will happen over the next year. And so the question around investment is important, and the question around the history of what was happening to these spaces to really ensure that there's not even that possibility to have a health system to meet the demands and needs of the population is important. And the Liberia chapter considers and thinks about how confinement didn't help because that wasn't the solution that was needed. And that the solution that was needed, creating the kind of skeleton for primary care and healthcare, was needed decades before the outbreak. And we're witnessing this right now, actually, of what does confinement do in some cases to fuel disease in Gaza? And the fact that the Israeli assault on Palestinians in Gaza led to the proliferation of polio. And now, because of that, there's a vaccination campaign that hopefully can help to remedy the harm that has been caused. But if not for the Gaza being what some have described as an open air prison and the genocide that's happening, this disease, polio, would not have had a comeback. And so when I say that there are far more infectious diseases than happening now than should have, it's because society, by virtue of war, by virtue of the kind of post-colonial context, not paying people what they're owed, the question around incarcerating people, which, why do we have such systems to begin with, and so forth, are what fuels it. And we have the tools, and we have had the tools to understand how bacteria and viruses are transmitted for well over a century and a half. And yet, the things that keep making them occur over and over again is the lack of preparedness, the lack of funding and truly universal care, not just at the level of one nation state here or there, but on a global scale. Mm.
Your work outlines how lots of people's experiences of infectious disease are experiences of abandonment, if not ones of direct violence from public institutions, but also that successful public health measures require at least some amount of public trust, public cohesion, things like that. And often a lot of responses to this particular problem is to call people idiots for not trusting medicine. I would love to get your thoughts on the political implications of that trust gap, if you like, in the context of COVID particularly, and what we might be able to do about it.
If I want to focus on the US for more specifically, I'll start there. I'll explain why there isn't much trust in society or by society towards the government. Early on during the COVID pandemic, once a vaccine was found, December 2020, January 2021, there was a slight vaccine skepticism amongst African Americans. And part of that had to do with the history and legacy of medical experimentation that existed in the United States, whereby, and this was brought up, people were forcibly sterilized in the US, in North Carolina, and so forth, African Americans, that is, disproportionately, as well as Tuskegee experiments that happened where African American men were put into a study in which they did not even receive treatment, thinking that they did, and so forth. And I bring that up just to say that at least when a government actively forced a population to travel across an ocean and lose their identity and so forth and say that they were less than and put them in apartheid environments and so forth, it is very difficult to trust that same government has your best interest in mind with respect to your health. And so the skepticism in that context was very real, and I can understand why that existed when the history wasn't very kind to African Americans and Black people as a whole. But beyond that, and this is to the general population, the same government that refuses to have a universal health care then suddenly says, oh, we'll offer you a free vaccine. The skepticism arose by virtue of the fact that America does not provide much to its citizens as a government. And trust is only possible if, for at the level of the state, if the state can show and demonstrate that it cares about its population, that it will provide basic amenities, that people will feel like they have a say in discussion. So there could have been active town halls, virtual or in other contexts, in which people could explain, like, what is a virus? What is a herd immunity? What is the significance of washing one's hands and so forth? Very few people like to be told what to do, but when given the space to have open discussions through teach-ins, town halls, and so forth, that is something that can help to build the trust within society, as opposed to what did occur in the US, and in the US isn't an exception to this. The skepticism happened here in Germany. Germany is a state that does provide far more to its citizens, and yet the skepticism was about the same, if not more, in some cases, precisely because of the individualism that is rampant in Western societies, as well as the vaccine skepticism that is also associated with the Steiner philosophy and so forth. And so there's a different history operating here in Germany that also creates skepticism by the government for historical reasons. But then there was also a lack of spaces for people to feel like they could gather and talk and discuss and so forth. And not everyone was well-meaning in their skepticism. Some people used it as a kind of platform to then spew in the German context anti-Semitism and other like very damaging philosophies and rhetoric. But some of that could have been avoided, not with the neo-Nazi rhetoric, but at least with the other skeptics. There should have been space for a discussion, question, answer, so forth. And the work should have been done decades ago with respect to ensuring that people could feel like their government cared for them, or that society is organized in such a way that people are able to get the care that they need.
Mm. Your work references prison cell writing and sickbed writing. To round off, I would love to hear your thoughts on the similarities between those two forms of political inquiry. What looking, asking questions, writing from these positions gives us as political agents?
So one thing that I had a lot of time to do during the early parts of the pandemic is not only to write, but to read extensively some of the kind of, I guess, typical characters that would circulate and recirculate include Octavia Butler, Toni Morrison, and so forth, but also someone like Deborah Levy, who said in Things I Don't Want to Know, it's like she had written, it's exhausting to learn how to become a subject, and it's hard enough learning how to become a writer. And this is something I felt like I needed to do. It's like learning to become a writer through also a kind of period of confinement, and to do so while looking towards, yeah, so many brilliant thinkers and writers. And so when I was writing this book, I thought it was also significant to think about writers who were doing this craft in spaces of confinement as well. So the most significant person in the book who's doing that, who I'm thinking about, not just Harriet Jacobs, but also Virginia Woolf and her writing, and thinking about how that also related to Kathy Bowden in the prison chapter, because she was an activist, was part of the Weather Underground, but then also incarcerated in prison and writing alongside the people who were incarcerated with her at Bedford Hills. And prison writing for me has been and continues to be important when I think about Antonio Gramsci's work, or George Jackson, Soledad Brother, that there is something, as much as I hate confinement or forced confinement, like there is something also beautiful about some of the composition that is emerging in from these people who are in many cases, it's not always, but in some many cases left-leaning, people who are forced to reflect on their psyche, their physical state, a society, what they want, their dreams, in some cases writing letters to people, revealing bowel movements, whatever is happening to them. And I find that beautiful. And so in a sense, my book is trying to like work through that, which is why there are elements in which the personal finds its way to the surface, because I was also reflecting on and thinking about my own position as a writer who felt at times confined and restricted, but also it was also in these periods of looking inward that I could also find some beauty in the world. And maybe sometimes I found it in myself, but not always. And so, yeah, the writer and the writing mind and is something that that was significant, especially the various literary inspirations I had made me deepen my sense of like how disease, the body,
and more specifically, how literature can really help to ignite the imagination, even when we feel like we're surrounded by despair.
Edna, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Navara Media from just £1 a month. Head to navara.media/support or face the consequences.